Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Joint Subcommittee on Revenue of the Student Success Committee. We are going to go through a couple of things tonight. First, we're going to look at an overview from the 30,000-foot level on commercial activity tax and some hybrids. Then we're going to look at some Oregon tax incidence modeling of what happens to some of these plans when groceries are exempt from this tax. And then what I'd like to do, if you are all willing, is to kind of go down the line and express your opinion, feeling, support, opposition toward any one of these plans and mix and max or however you want to characterize it. So let's start with the options. This is in OLIS, Options for Education Revenue, Joint Subcommittee on Revenue, the CAT, the MCAT 1 and MCAT 2. Very creative titles that we came up with. Mr. Alanek.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. So this, it's the other one, Austin. So this is something that was presented to the full committee last Thursday, and it provides kind of a cheat sheet or a very high-level review of the parameters or factors for three different versions of the tax. So the CAT is the commercial activities tax, and the MCAT is the modified commercial activities tax, where the M represents that there is some sort of deduction from the business receipts of the firms. So in all cases, the who pays is the same. It's all business entities. The tax rate does change across the three. It goes from 0.37 to 0.45 to roughly a 0.9. We're still working on some of the estimates for the MCAT 2. And the reason that rate changes is that these are all geared toward raising $1 billion in tax year 2020. They all have an initial fee of $250 that would apply to filers below $1 million, as well as those above. Some of the thresholds on the policies, those are all the same. Below $150,000, a business wouldn't have to register. Between $150,000 and $1 million, they would pay the $250, and then above $1 million, they'd pay the $250 plus the mentioned tax rate. Within all three of these, the list of exemptions is two. The first one is petroleum, and that's largely due to the revenue from that needing to go to the highway fund and cannot go to education, so they're exempt from the tax. And the other piece are those entities that are subject to the medical provider taxes. And that has to do with some other activities that have gone on this session. Possible others, Chair Haas indicated that groceries is a piece. When I put this together last week, that wasn't necessarily part of that list, but would be another exemption. So then the other parameter that changes, so we talked about the tax rate changing across the three categories, and then the other piece that changes is a deduction. Under the CAT, there is no deduction, so that has the lowest rate. This is the broadest base and the lowest rate. So if you think about the discussions we've had this session about the size of the tax base and how that changes among the different kinds of taxes, so in this one, there are no deductions, so that has the lowest rate. When we get to MCAT 1, we have a deduction that is equal to 25% of the greater of either business inputs or labor. And to pay for that, if you will, the tax rate goes from 0.37% to 0.45%. Again, that $1 billion target is being held fixed. And in the MCAT 2, the deduction is increased to 100% of the greater of inputs or labor. And there is an apportionment piece for multi-state companies that would come into play here. But in this case, the tax rate may be as high as 0.9. We're actually still working through some of the data and making this estimate. But the point is that to pay for the larger deduction, the tax rate would need to increase to compensate for that. And in all, so that is the activities tax under three different versions. And then the personal income tax is the same for all three, where the rate cut is the same that we've been talking about recently. It's the 0.25 percentage point reduction in the first three brackets. And then all of them start on 1-1-2020. Then the bottom two tables there show current estimates for the timing of the revenue impacts. This, now we get into numbers that look more like our traditional revenue impact statements. And they are spelled out separately, so you have the commercial activity tax and the personal income tax, where in 1921, with a start date of 1/1/2020, the commercial activity tax brings in about $1.7 billion, and about $300 million is spent on the personal income tax cut. So that gets down to about $1.4 billion for 1921. We are still working with the Department of Revenue on the logistics of how they could administer the tax and when they would start collecting and how that cash flow would work. So those numbers will be modified as we move forward. And then the amount collected here or spent through the personal income tax is forecast out through 25-27. So that is the very high level view, where the only change really between or among the policies is some kind of deduction that is paid for by a higher rate. And those two parameters work in conjunction with each other. So I don't know if there are questions there or if you want me
questions
to move
on this overview before we go to the modeling. Senator Benz.
Mr. Chair, I have a lot of questions, but I think they're of the general nature, so I'll wait until done with the presentation.
Okay. Anybody else have any questions on this overview of those? If not, then Chris, could you finish modeling some of these plans with the groceries exemption? Can you show us what that does?
So the other handout that is in OLIS is comparable to the information that was shared with the committee last week, I think Tuesday maybe. And so as we have that pulled up here, the only difference between the information that was shared last week and this is that groceries are exempt and the tax rates increase to pay for that exemption. So last week we had a commercial activities tax option one. Now we have an option 1A where the tax rate is now 0.41% instead of 0.37%. And the exemptions now include groceries. So there are three items that are exempt: petroleum, medical provider taxpayers, and groceries. Everything else is the same. And the static impact there is going to be roughly the same, again, because of the target of $1 billion in 2020. So this is a flat rate, 0.41, including the exemption with groceries. And then we have a modified commercial activities tax, option 2A, which has the exemption for groceries, the flat rate, and also has a 25% deduction for the business inputs or labor. So the difference between option 2A and 1A is the 25% deduction for business inputs and labor.
So that rate goes up considerably when you allow those deductions in some ways like an income tax off your tax base.
Correct. So when going from 1A to 2A, the only difference is the deduction. So the tax rate has to go from 0.41% to 0.49% to pay for that deduction. And then scrolling down, the last four pages are what has become the familiar OTIM output. And so the first one is CAT option 1A. So we have the flat rate of 0.41%. And the exemption that now includes groceries. Everything else is the same. And the output here is fairly similar to what we have, what was shared last week, CAT option one, which was a 0.37% rate and no exemption for groceries. And it has the familiar story where some of the key parameters that the committee has been interested in, the employment impact is still slightly on the negative side, minus 0.03%, so it's about 800 jobs. And the price levels are increased at 0.33%. The wage index is not much affected, and investment is slightly less under this scenario. And this is our standard output. And then the next sheet is the L version of this, where going back to that productivity parameter that we've talked about, just
the long term,
that's what the L stands for. And so the impacts are larger because the time horizon is longer than the 5-year period. And so here, this has it embedded by turning on this productivity parameter. It has the assumption that the money that is being dedicated to schools is spent efficiently, makes its way into basically improving the human capital of the state. And so over the longer term, we expect to see that in more positive economic indicators. For example, the employment is up by 3.6, or up by 0.13%. Population is up a little bit, investment is up, and wages are up. And that's what we've seen for the theme every time we've produced one of these L versions. And then scrolling down to the next page, we have the MCAT option 2A. So compared to last week, now the rate is 0.49 with the exemption for groceries.
So 0.49, you get your 25% deduction for labor inputs or business inputs, and groceries are exempt.
Correct. So it's all of those. So now all of those combined, now the rate has been pushed up to, we're still under 0.5%, but it's right at 0.49%. And the output, again, are fairly similar even to the CAT option 1A a couple pages prior, where the employment impact is slightly negative, price levels are up, not much of an impact. And here it's actually zero on the wage impact for the wage index, and then just slightly negative on the investment. And then if we go to the L version of it, then all of those parameters again turn positive again over a long time period, assuming, making all of the assumptions embedded in how the money is spent within education. Mm-hmm. And the employment is up by 3,500, so 3,700, 0.14%. We still have the price level increasing, but there are positives to the return to capital and the wage index. And so those are the basic OTIM outputs for the models that we're talking about. The big difference between this set of runs and what was shared last week is the exemption for groceries. So it doesn't appreciably change the landscape.
The economics on 2 would seem to be very slightly better with the hybrid and groceries than with just groceries. Or are they too close to call?
I think they're, my computer just died. I think they're very similar. They are slightly positive. We often get these questions about the statistical difference between these. So we have changes of 0.14% or 0.4% and some sort of confidence interval. And these are really different kinds of models. So we can't, that discussion doesn't really pertain to these changes.
All right.
But so they are a little more positive, but generally they're pretty much the same. This is a high level, very large scale change. So any small differences in these percentage changes, it's hard to say that that really amounts to an appreciable change.
Okay. But by exempting groceries, that does change things. Can you give us your pros and cons on that?
So the pros and cons on the groceries is it helps with some in-state pyramiding at food there. The con, that's probably the biggest one, as well as helping a lower income in terms of it being a more progressive policy with lower income. For groceries, taking a larger share of the budget pie for lower income families than larger or higher income folks. On the con side is that we are offsetting that by increasing the tax rate. Again, and that we're holding that $1 billion fixed. So the tax rate on all non-grocery items is a little higher than it would be otherwise.
Mr. Chair? What would, how would we be defining groceries in this model?
What we're looking at here is groceries for the retail and wholesale sector.
So it's food, and what else is covered under there?
The definition that we're looking to tie to is the SNAP definition used at the federal level. So
anything that the SNAP card can be used for?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
And then what, to follow up, what do we gain by the inputs deduction of 25%. What is the rationale for that?
The rationale there is, again, getting at mitigating some of the pyramiding effect. Mm-hmm. Is to some extent, if we think about the discussions we've had, when we start with the gross receipts, that's the largest base. That's all of the goods and services sold in Oregon. And some of those are business-to-business purchases. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've heard that in sales tax states. When those states collect their sales tax, about 35 to 40% of that tax is paid by businesses. And one of the criticisms of a gross receipts tax is its pyramiding effect. And to include some sort of deduction acknowledges or addresses that pyramiding to some extent. And what's been modeled here is a 25% exclusion or deduction.
And finally, how far up the Ernst & Young rating would we move if we did, say, this option 2A?
Well, most of these options, it would be the same for all of these because it would raise $1 billion.
Correct. Okay. So they're all the same in that regard.
They would all be in the same in that regard. And I would have to pull that up. I think right now we're at the 7th lowest. And that moves us up to about 16th or so, depending on my quick math.
16th lowest.
Yes.
So we'd move up 9 spots?
9 or 10 spots, yeah, give or take.
Thank you.
Any other questions on groceries, Senator Smith Warner?
You're always trying to demote me, Senator. Not on groceries yet, but I have a quick question from Chris, and I'm certain you have covered this in the past, so I apologize. But I was just noticing that the brackets and the changes in disposable household income. I had just been in my head assuming they were quintiles, and then I just looked and thought, oh no, there are 8. And in this math system, there cannot be 8 quintiles. So can you tell me how those divisions were picked or allocated?
Yeah, we've talked about that and about doing quintiles or this, and the decision was made a long time ago in terms of building it, Tim, and that quintiles, for some folks, that's very intuitive, but for other folks, they want the dollar amount. And so these groups are largely driven by the data source inputs going into OTIM. And they're one of the key input pieces into this is something called the implant. It's an input-output matrix, and that they have 9 households. And we combine the bottom 2.
Okay. Yeah. And so, if I may follow up. So therefore, do you have a sense of what the balance is between, you know, like, is it about in eighths? Is it, you know, is a third of the returns in the top one and 2/3 are in the, you know, because that's the other thing about quintiles, then, you know, it's about 20% numerically. Because I know we've had a lot of discussions about how many people are in those bottom couple of things, and really that's what I'm trying to get to. Because when we talk about the progressivity or regressivity, it's important to know how many people are in each of these divisions or approximately.
Yes, we can. Well, to start off with, in comparing it to it sounds like you're thinking of the personal income tax system.
Yes. Partly.
Now, that is tax returns. These are households. So we do a transformation there, with the biggest piece being all of the dependents. So there might be 100,000, 125,000 dependents who are filing their tax return. I usually describe these as the high school kids working in McDonald's who are filing their own tax return. And so they do show up, if you're just looking at the PIT statistics, they aren't that lower. There are some very wealthy 5-year-olds, but many of them are focused at the lower end. And so when we take this, one of the processes we do when we update OTIM is we start with those personal income tax returns, and we try to develop households from those returns. And that's the biggest change right there. So I can see if I can translate this into people as opposed to households. Right off the bat, I would probably just use an average household, people per household type of metric. Okay. But I can get numbers of people for you if you'd like.
I don't know that I need exact numbers, but I would just say in, I think, to inform the conversation when we are talking about how progressive or regressive it is, to have a better sense of how many are in each of these. You know, if the lowest one, well, I will be extremely specific, because in the long-term ones, the top, you know, four or five, like the top categories all increase, and it's only the bottom one or two that decrease. Well, if indeed that is less than 5% of the population, well, you know, then that's great. But if that's, you know, if that bottom one is 20% of all filers, that's a bigger issue. That's a very different issue. So I guess I'm trying to see if I can, if we can get as much information out of the model as possible.
Yes, we can get that for you.
Okay, thank you.
Questions on the grocery exemption or any of these models that we've seen to date? Rep. Smith Warner.
Thank you for giving me another opportunity, and this time I will talk about grocery exemption, which is, I will just give my, I think the voters of this state had the opportunity to exempt groceries from taxation on the ballot last year, and they chose pretty solidly not to. So I continue to not be crazy about exempting them out of this. I think the voters have spoken.
Senator Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it open season on any kind of questions?
Yeah, I do want to, I guess, encourage all of us to weigh in on one or two of these or weigh in against them. So however you want to go through it, but you have the floor, Senator Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Chris, the concept of a commercial activities or this tax is that there's no regard to profit. And thus, as we look at this in a economy that's in a recession, what does this do to our economy? Does it make it worse, or what happens when there's no regard to profit and you have a grocery receipts or a capital activities tax?
There are at least a couple sides to that. For the businesses that are paying it, it is more difficult because there isn't that profit margin that it would come out of. Part of the policy reason for doing this is the stability for the school funding through those recessions. These consumption taxes, consumption doesn't, historically hasn't moved as much as the profits. Like the corporate income tax is one of the most volatile taxes. And so when we hit a recession, and everybody here has experienced this on the budget side with such a dependence on the income taxes, that when we do hit a recession, they tend to fall hard. This provides a little bit of a mitigating factor against that because the consumption doesn't fall off as quickly as the income tax does. But it does, there is that side on the, that perspective on the business side where there isn't that profit margin to pay those taxes.
Follow up.
Senator Benz.
Thank you. There was a suggestion over the weekend and when I was having conversations regarding this with my cousin, among others, that the number of small businesses in Oregon was one of the highest in the nation, somewhere around 95%. And I think when one thinks of business in Oregon, you usually think of Walmart or Target or somebody like that. You don't think of the enormous number of small businesses. It would be worthwhile if we could get some feedback on whether or not that's a correct number.
Sure.
So that we have some idea of what that last question means in regard to a huge number of smaller businesses as opposed to several large. And then another question that came up was whether or not this tax was deductible against Oregon income. It would obviously be deductible against federal income, but I don't think our own taxes are deductible against income tax, that is. So what would be the right thing to do here, and what does your model anticipate?
Right now, that is a policy call in terms of the taxes being deductible. Trying to think of it. Right now, we're not modeling them as being deducted off of like the corporate income tax. I mean, they're deducted off federal taxes,
but not off Oregon tax. Follow up, Mr. Chair. Okay. This particular model, I think I asked last time whether or not it took into account other things this legislature might choose to do in this session. That would be impossible for you to predict, so I assume the model does not.
But if we were to proceed with a cap and trade mandate, and if we were to proceed with other costs that were imposed in the broadest sense to a business, perhaps paid family leave, how would you factor those into this model? And would they, if you did, would they have an impact on your bottom line that you're showing us here? Because this appears to be a vacuum and does not take into account those other possible costs to business.
That's correct. Right now, it's a current law perspective. So some of these other policies that you mentioned aren't embedded in the models that we have right now. And the extent to which we could include them, I would have to look at those policies individually, because right now OTIM is really structured for tax policy, and I'd have to think about how we might include some of these other costs depending on the policies, whether it's family leave or cap and trade.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's been quite a bit of discussion about how meaningful, and I think it is, it would be to this particular model that the money gets spent on education. Articles and papers and whatnot have suggested that because of our unfortunate situation regarding PERS, it's possible that a bunch of that money might instead go to PERS. Would that change the outcome of your model? If the money, let's say half of it was used to pay down PERS debt in a failure to maintain effort, let's say, way.
I guess the easiest way to think about that might be, in the modeling that we're doing, they're coming out in pairs. Like even today, we have a 1A, 1AL, 2A, and 2AL. And the first version doesn't assume the productivity gains, if you will, in terms of the spending. So on something like that, it might be more akin to the non-L version of the OTIM output. Being okay, we're all of that money just goes back into doing more of the same and going into not necessarily going to PERS, because that's not a parameter that's in this model per se. But that might be the non-L versions might be more akin to that analysis as opposed to the L versions, because embedded in that is the gains to the assumed gains to human capital investments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let's assume at some point in the future, 4 years from now, someone wanted to raise this tax. What would the proper parameters for making that decision be? What would we look back at when we see this and say, here's what we looked at in determining the proper rate? In other words, how would one go to those who might want to raise this later and say, well, this is what we used last time. These were the underlying foundations for raising the tax. What would your summary of that be? I could go through this and pull them out myself, but I'd rather hear it from you.
Okay, so to understand your question, we're 2 years down the road, the tax is in place, and now we want to change it, increase it or not. A lot of that might stem from the spending side in terms of how successfully the money is being spent in school and being directed towards schools, or however the money is handled on the Ways and Means side. In terms of tracking the estimates that my office makes, we have the static estimates are really the best ones, because we can actually say that in 2020 or 2021, we're going to collect these amounts. And that's what we could compare to. The OTIM output are really kind of two different versions of reality under one tax system or another. So there's no, this is something that we've struggled with, where we can't go back and confirm that the employment effect was X or Y or the wage level. We can actually, when we're 2 years down the road, we can look at some of those factors, but there are so many other things that happen in the economy, it's hard to isolate a change in the wage level or prices to one particular policy. But that might be some of the consideration as to what other factors did happen over that time period that might have had an impact on these parameters.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up. Thank you for that answer. Let's assume a hypothetical of a business that makes $2 million a year. And it appears, I'm going to use the 33 So let's assume 39. Let's assume that they are paying roughly $3,900 in tax on that second $1 million. I think that'd be about right. But that's not really the fear that I've heard expressed by various people. They basically said they're worried about that pyramiding effect of they have to pay somebody else's $3,900 and somebody else's $3,900 in the cost of the goods that they might be acquiring. And then I think you pointed out that the 0.25% deduction would, in some fashion, help offset that pyramiding effect. I guess the question is by how much? Because I saw considerable fear that the pyramiding was the real problem, not the $3,900. Is that a correct analysis by the people I've been talking to of the impact of this particular tax?
Well, the pyramiding concern there, the aspect of it is, you know, we can construct examples of how things get passed on from one business to the next. And any business that, say you have an Oregon business that half of their sales are in Oregon and half of them sales are exported. And so now they're going to pay, or under this plan, if it were to become law, they would pay the activities tax on the Oregon sales portion, but not necessarily on the part that's exported. So depending on the markets that they're working in, they might be able to adjust their costs and spread them out to all of their customers versus just Oregon. They won't necessarily have to focus within Oregon. Now, that depends on the sector that they're operating in and what competition they're facing in other states. A lot of the pyramiding I hear about focuses on, or it seems to have this implicit assumption that all of the business is focused within Oregon and goes through multiple stages. And that could certainly be true. You can construct an example that way, but the question is how well does that example represent the reality? And with many states or with many companies having some Oregon sales and some exported sales, and depending on the market that they're in, they can respond to a variety of ways with that pyramiding in terms of passing on the costs. At the end of the day, it'll be a cost of doing business for them, and to the extent they can pass it off to their output markets, they may. But it's a good question, it's the right question. It's difficult to answer as to what it looks like for everybody.
Senator Benz. So one of the situations that was placed to me by my cousin was, when do people start paying this tax? Assuming it started next year, January 1st, and assuming they didn't know how much they were going to sell, how do they know when they start paying it? Do they wait until their sales exceed the $1 million and then start paying by the month, or what happens?
So the administration that's envisioned now is a quarterly payment system. So assuming the tax takes effect 1/1/2020, the first payments would be due April 1st with a few weeks or so to pay it, so sometime in April. And for some companies, if they're large enough, they know they're going to blow by that $1 million threshold so they can make those payments. Other companies, it will depend on if a given company is, if they have their sales that vacillate between $800,000 and $1.2 million, it probably wouldn't be till the end of the year that would kick in. At right now, DOR would have some rulemaking authority on figuring that part out. We also envision right now is that there would be no penalty in interest for this first year, since it is a new tax and all the taxpayers would need to be getting used to exactly how that works. So that first year would be an adjustment period.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Senator Benz. So I'm going to go back to the groceries. I should have asked this during the grocery segment, but here we are. The question is because of the regressive nature of this particular thing on senior citizens. So if they go down to the grocery store after this tax is passed, what can they anticipate the impact to be? Again, you already took us through the unknowns when it comes to where the groceries came from to begin with. And your model suggests an increase of about 0.33% or a third of a penny, but that doesn't take into account stacking, or does it?
To the best we have to incorporate the stacking is what's referred to as an input output output model that's in the core of this, and that has the intersectoral trading. So that's the best we can do there. And the bottom line, the price increase is the general level, and that's just for all products. It boils down all the prices in Oregon down to one index. And so that increases there. And so part of the reason that doesn't change much across these parameters is that while we're exempting groceries, we're increasing the rate on other items. So that overall doesn't really change. So for the price on groceries, there shouldn't be, I wouldn't think there'd be a change in the price of the groceries per se, because the tax isn't, they'd be exempt from the tax.
You're assuming there's no freight to get it there. You're assuming a whole bunch of stuff that right. grocery stores all pay that don't have much to do with groceries, like all the other stuff that they do now. That would cause the cost of those goods to go up by some amount, even though they don't have to pay it. Everybody else gets to, because it's factored into the good when it's sold to the grocery store. Am I correct there? I mean, for example, if a rancher sells a cow and it goes through the process and it eventually makes its way to the grocery store, it's going to carry all of the taxes that have been imposed to the extent they're generated in Oregon. Isn't that a correct statement?
That's correct. And you also have grocery stores that sell non-grocery items.
I don't.
So right. the grocery, that might be a little cleaner one, where the groceries are exempt, but the store sells non-grocery items, not to the extent. Now we get to the question of how that individual business is going to respond to the tax, because at the end of the day, they'll look at their gross receipts and pay the tax on that. And that gets at it not being a transactional tax, as opposed to the retail sales tax. When you go into a store and buy something, here's my receipt, here's the tax that I paid on it. This isn't that kind of transactional tax. So it's at the end of the year, or, well, when they settle up, that they pay that tax on a quarterly basis, and they're not singling out those dollars. And so that gets into a lot of the unknowns about how the businesses would respond to what their pricing strategies are.
I think this is my last question, Mr. Chair, for at least for the moment. The discussion I had on Saturday with various others did focus on that difference between the sales tax and the capital activities tax, and it was corporate activities tax. The fact that the customer knows they're paying the tax, and this isn't. And this is to be compared to this tax, where the owner knows they're paying the tax, or the seller knows they're paying the tax, and may or may not have the pricing power to pass it on. And that was a pretty interesting distinction, which I had not thought of before, because the sales tax is on the customer to decide to pay it in essence. On this tax, not so much. Now it's a close call, but if you're in a competitive marketplace, and I like to use Ontario as an example, because we currently enjoy no sales tax, but as each of these things comes into play, makes it more challenging to compete with those who do have a sales tax, because you're driving the costs up. So I'm happy to see the discussion about the groceries being perhaps left out. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I just want to clarify or attempt to clarify something, Senator Vance, about this money going to PERS. That there will be language in House Bill 2019 outside the scope of this committee that will set up the fund for student success, in which 100% of the money raised through whatever scheme we pick, that 100% of this will be dedicated to those things that the committee settles on. And, you know, there's several recommendations from early learning to longer school years. Will not go to PERS, will not go to Fish and Wildlife, not go to Human Services. It will be a fund dedicated to those educational services.
Follow up to that, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Senator Benz.
Right. So that would be as good as the next legislature showing up, given the nature of legislators. It's a valiant effort.
Shoot for valiant. Senator Burdick.
Chris, states that have the sales tax also have the pyramiding issue. How does the pyramiding issue for a system like this compare to, say, if we had a sales tax? Is it less of a problem, more of a problem, or is it about the same?
That's an excellent question. we've looked at that, and we've done a little bit of digging into that issue, and don't have the best answer yet. I think my instinct would be that it'd be fairly similar. Some of the differences are with their sales tax, it's a more visible tax. So the companies can feel that a little bit more to the extent that they pay attention to the tax, or if they just factor that into the overall business costs. Whereas the activities tax, it doesn't show up on any sort of receipt. So you don't really know how, when you go to buy that computer or that desk, you don't know how much of that tax is there. But under standard economic assumptions of competitive markets, that all should kind of even out at the end of the day, because those are all just costs of doing business. And for all of the structures in the different state economies, to the extent that they vary, the goods and services, there is an equilibrium there.
So this 25% offset for the labor inputs, is how does that demonstrably make us more less of a pyramiding problem than it would say if we had a sales tax?
Well, I think it changes, given that any size of a deduction results in a higher tax rate, again, the parameters for the task here, it shifts it to different items, perhaps. Mm-hmm. And we're just moving things around. So there is a deduction, and it does allow for any business to mitigate some of those costs. Then the higher rate shifts some of those costs. So it's a difficult question to answer as to exactly how that would be spread out across the various goods and services within the economy.
Follow up. No state has a sales tax as low as 0.49%. How does this translate? For example, if you were to take this $1 billion a year and have a sales tax instead, about what would the sales tax be if it was a sales tax only on business? Or would that even be possible?
I'm not sure that would be possible, but sales tax rates in general are 5, 6, or 7% for the states that have them.
And that's what business pays.
Right, on that right. product when they're buying things retail. Yeah. Right.
Okay, thank you.
Rep. Smith Warner has kind of weighed in on this. I think we know where you live.
Thank you. I had a response in particular to both of the senators' comments. Just to go back, I think it is challenging for us to predict how business behavior responds to individual state tax policy. And I would like to, I think your point is a good one, Senator Burdick, about how much lower of a percentage we are talking than sales tax, which has a similar pyramiding impact. But number one, I always want to go back to the fact that whether it's Fred Meyer or Albertsons or Sears, I'm dating myself, there are ads that with regional pricing, and that state tax policy has little to no impact on that. Regional pricing is regional pricing, and I believe we are searching too far to believe that. So the impact of state tax has a very limited effect, particularly on bigger organizations on their pricing. And number two, I was thinking when Senator Bentz was asking about the impact on the increases, it made me think, oh yes, I am so looking forward to the decrease that I will be getting from the federal tax corporate rate decrease from 35% to 22%, I think it ended up. So I'm looking forward to all of my goods and services being reduced in price by a third from that. And I'm obviously speaking in jest, but it is part of the whole individual pricing is not super sensitive even to that, which is a much bigger and national decrease in tax rates. So.
The other Rep. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. First of all, I appreciate all the work that our revenue folks have done. Chris, A+, you've done a great job presenting very complicated information in a very readable way. So thank you for doing that. I don't think I have too much that I want to add. I appreciate everyone's questions on this. The one area that I'm still trying to work through in my mind, and this plays large in Eastern Oregon, is the role of intermediaries in sales activities. And I've been able to have good conversations with the co-chair, and I appreciate that. But quite often in, or not but, quite often in agriculture, there's intermediaries that play a role in the sale of commodities that will end up out of state, and that's their purpose. But the initial sale, because of the way agriculture work, may occur through a cooperative or some other intermediary. And so I want to make sure that we have a conversation related to that. That was an issue that occurred in 2009 under Measure 67. And at the time, Speaker Hunt came back with an amendment to address that issue. And so that's on my mind. What's also on my mind is taking a look at our lowest households and ensuring that we don't have too large of a negative repercussion on them, especially those under the 34,000 range. While I don't know the exact statistical data, I'm going to assume a good share of those may be senior citizens on fixed incomes or folks who don't have the ability to, for one reason or another, to raise their income. And so I want to be sensitive to that issue. Selfishly, from a District 57 perspective, the notion that the first $1 million is 250. In first million in sales, the amount of tax is $250, really will provide tremendous assurance to many, many small businesses who reside on Main Street, whether in Condon or Heppner or Milton Freewater. And so that's comforting. I'm still a little uncertain about those businesses, and I've mentioned this already, so I apologize for repeating myself, but those businesses that already pay other income tax into the state of Oregon, wine, beer, distilled spirits comes to mind, and there may be others out there that I don't know of. The last thing that I'd share with you, and I don't know how this plays through, but I think about those businesses that, and I'll use realtors as an example, that may have $40 million in real estate sales, but by the time they're done paying their commissions to independent contractors or however that contractual relationship works out, that firm actually may only have a couple $1 million. And I'm uneasy knowing that an entity may be asked to pay on a large, large amount when knowing that their business structure in reality is much, much smaller. But I'm not sure I'm sophisticated to solve that. And while I'm sympathetic to that issue, I think folks in business and industry and the realtors, et cetera, can help us work through that if that's an outstanding issue. All in all, though, I think, Mr. Co-Chair, this seems like a balanced package and one that collectively will eventually take a vote on to decide if this is how we want to move forward.
Yes.
So thank you.
Thank you, Rep. Smith. Two quick points, Chris. If you could point out, there are fixes for the two things you mentioned, Rep. Smith. On one is the ag co-ops, and one on real estate commissions. Chris, if you could give us, I think, the summary of those fixes.
I think what you're getting at, two of them, some of the language that we're working on would exclude, it's really the wholesale sector, and it's similar to the co-ops. So there would be an exemption because the goal of the policy or the starting point would be Oregon sales. So if it's really not an Oregon sale, and that gets at some of the fix that we had. So we're confirming some language that would make it in there, whether or not that would be wrapped up in the wholesale issue or something different needs to be there. And with respect to realtors, part of that might be that, depending on the issue, for the money that flows through there, the value of a home that gets sold wouldn't be part of the Oregon sales. It would just be the commission piece. Mm. And that kind of issue pops up in several different business structures where there's a transfer of money where the business itself is kind of an intermediary.
That's a great point.
So those aren't part of the sales.
Okay.
Senator Benson,
I'm not sure if this question and the lack of someone having already asked it is a reflection on generational issues or not, but talk about the internet if you could, please. Because one of the issues that did come up over the weekend was if we drive the cost up of our retail operators, does that drive more people to internet sales? And if so, do we care because we can tax the sales on the internet or not?
I think it's the last part of that where the sales into the state would create the nexus and they would have to be paying that tax. So if I go online and I buy a computer and it gets shipped here, then that makes that company subject, depending on all of the parameters of the structure of the tax, they'd be subject to that tax.
Senator Burdick, did you want to weigh in on
this? Yes, I like the option where we exempt groceries and have the input deduction of 25%. I think it's 2A is my favorite. Responding to Representative Smith Warner's comment about the grocery ballot measure, I think a big part of the messaging was we don't need to change the Constitution because we have no intention of taxing groceries. And so I know it went down. It was a hard-fought campaign. I took a little different message out of it because of the campaign against it.
Rep. Davidson.
So much has been asked and addressed tonight. I would like to add that any of these options will add stability to our revenue. It's a kind of tax we don't have currently, and something we haven't mentioned in a while when we think back to our goals or objectives in looking at a new type of revenue stream is we wanted a very broad base, a low rate, and also add stability for being able to fund education. So these options all meet that test for me. It's a kind of tax that's different and added to our current revenue streams would add a degree of stability we don't have now. And the second thing I wanted to mention, responding to a couple of comments related to pyramiding, I would like to emphasize that part of this package is not only the tax, but the personal income tax reductions. And several of you have talked about that and the degree to which it's progressive and would help those Oregon individuals in the lower three tax brackets. It's only a very small number of people paying at the very top rate who would not benefit from that particular part of this plan. But I think that's a really important part of the proposal to keep in mind, that this is both a tax, a new tax to invest in education, but it's also a tax reduction for many Oregonians. And all of these options meet that test for me as well.
Thank you. I would just say for myself that if we're going to do a commercial activity tax, my preference would be very simple and a low rate. I am moved by the arguments of
a grocery exemption to help keep average Oregonians whole, combined with the rate reduction. And so I think we'll keep looking at models on this. Thank you all for your indulgence tonight. We're getting down to the wire. We will meet again tomorrow at 6. We may have some new modeling to go through with the goal of getting the framework, a structure, and a rate set by Thursday and drafted amendment to look at next week. So we're putting a lot of work on the back of the LRO staff and legislative council, and I appreciate their efforts and appreciate yours. So unless there are any other comments, we will adjourn for the evening.